Today's program was brought to you by EscapeMaker.com. Visit a farm, escape through the net. Visit EscapeMaker.com for more.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to the very first edition of Taste Talks on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Sarah Zorn, the food editor at Northside Media, which produces the annual Taste Talks Festival in both Brooklyn and Chicago. Wonder where we got the name for this show. Picking up where the festival left off, the Taste Talks podcast will bring innovators from various fields, including music, art, media, design, and tech, together with luminaries from the food and restaurant world to expound on any and all topics related to taste. During today's show, we'll investigate the intersection of slow food and slow fashion by chatting with Farmers Web CEO Jennifer Goggin, along with Maxine Bidat, co-founder of the slow fashion brand Zadie, as well as spotlight some of our favorite farm-to-table restaurants throughout the U.S. But first, I will be joined in the studio by Nell Casey, the food editor of Gothamist, will help me break down the week's biggest culinary news. Hey there, Nell.
What's going on, Sarah?
Hey, so since we are kind of rocking a farm-to-table theme this week, a couple of newsy tidbits particularly caught my eye, and one of them, amazingly enough, has to do with Jon Stewart. Have you heard about his post-Daily Show plans?
I have heard about his plans. He and his wife bought a farm in New Jersey, what I understand.
I think that this will make the rest of us miss his presence on The Daily Show a little bit less when we hear what they've been up to. So what do you know about the farm in New Jersey? And Jon Stewart, by the way, is a known animal rights activist.
It's true. Well, he and his wife bought this farm in New Jersey, and they have plans to turn it into an animal sanctuary, farm animal sanctuary, which is something that we see across the country, different people rescuing animals that might otherwise end up on our dinner plates and giving them a safe and loving home, which is fantastic.
Well, and have you heard that actually the plan for, because they'll all live together with their children on this farm, and that they've actually promised animal shelter visits to the children in exchange for their completed homework.
I mean, that's, maybe they'd prefer an allowance, but maybe the kids like a trip to the farm.
Hey,
who knows?
I would have found it so much easier to get through calculus if I knew that there was a rescue piggy waiting for me at the end of the rainbow. It's amazing. But, well, and if you remember, Stewart also on The Daily Show tore into Chris Christie for vetoing a bill that would have banned gestation crates for pigs in New Jersey.
I just don't understand why you would look at something like that and think, no, I'm coming out, speaking up against this horrible, inhumane treatment of animals. That's not really a platform I would take as a politician, but...
Oh, anyway. Well, speaking of animal advocacy, the singer and PETA poster boy Morrissey is also
Morrissey,
a well-known vegan, and he has actually successfully convinced Madison Square Garden to go vegan as well. The entire Madison Square Garden for his June 27th performance. Quite a feat.
Well, Morrissey is sort of a go big or go home kind of guy. I mean, when you put out an album called Meat is Murder, you're not taking the subtle approach. And this is definitely not the first time that Morrissey has done this. I mean, he's asked other places where he's going to perform to go vegan and has even gone so far as to have security search patrons to make sure that there's no animal products or sneaking in meat foods, which is pretty extreme.
I know, no meatballs in your pockets, people.
No.
To catch the show on June 27th. It sounds like everybody is on board. Drew Neuporent actually has a burger shop, and he's not actually going to be serving all veggie burgers that night, but he will close in honor of Morrissey.
I just can't help but wonder, I mean, a lot of these places aren't equipped to produce a vegan menu, so is this going to be people showing up and literally nothing is open at Madison Square Garden? Is it going to be just a bunch of hungry concert goers?
Well, they could sneak hummus in their pockets, no?
That is true. I guess that remains to be seen.
Anyway, we are going to take a little break and come back with Farmers Web's Jennifer Goggin and Zadie's Maxine Bidat. You are listening to Taste Talks on the Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you. book a farm escape. EscapeMaker.com, a guide to local getaways, is offering a two-night farm escape that includes lodging, a visit to an apiary, wine tasting at a vineyard, and a special tour of Bulba Link Dairy and Bakehouse in Milford, New Jersey. Transportation is included. For details, visit EscapeMaker.com or come by the Bulba Link Dairy stand at the new open-air Fulton Stall Market on Front Street in the South Street Seaport District. Located where New York City's public food markets began in the 1800s, Fulton Stall Market is open weekends 10 to 5 and is the first farmers market in the city to offer ready-to-eat foods made by the farmers who produce them, along with a radio station, live music, and cooking workshops for families. Now offering spring flowers and plants, organic vegetables, pizza made in a wood-burning oven using farm ingredients, local fruit preserves, yogurts, and ice cream, and Bulba Link Dairy's famous artisanal cheese and breads. The market is a great reason to rediscover the authentic Seaport. For more information, visit FultonStallMarket.com.
So I am especially excited to welcome our first two official guests to Taste Talks, as I think that together they really embody what the podcast is about, finding commonalities between innovators from the food world and game changers from other creative fields. Jennifer Goggin is the vice chair of Slow Food NYC and co-founder of Farmers Web, an online marketplace that connects chefs and other wholesale buyers with local farms. Maxine Bedot is the co-founder of Zadie, a slow fashion brand and lifestyle destination, creating a new standard of transparency and sustainable production for the apparel industry. Thank you so much for being here, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
So I have to confess to a bit of slow food fatigue, not regarding the mission, of course, but concerning a few of the hot associated buzzwords like farm to table and local and seasonal and sustainable. They've become such catch-all terms in so many cases that they could refer to anything from a restaurant that buys a couple of vegetables from the green market to one that's actively involved and concerned with every rung of the supply chain. So, Jennifer, can you give us the slow food definition of slow food?
Sure. So for us, promoting slow food means we're promoting good, clean, and fair food. So that kind of covers everything from the production aspect of food to the way it was prepared, to the way that the workers are treated within the restaurants that are preparing it, and how people enjoy the food together. As in, we promote a communal idea of eating and eating where you sit down at the table and you reconnect with your family and your friends, as opposed to just grabbing something on the go in your car by yourself.
And you're actually on the Snail of Approval Committee, right?
Correct.
Which informally recognizes restaurants and bars and food stores and markets that contribute to the quality, authenticity, and sustainability of the New York City food supply.
Exactly.
Did I get that right?
That's correct.
So what precisely are the parameters for being awarded with a Snail of Approval?
So it's actually a pretty in-depth process. There's a vetting committee that goes through the restaurant or food establishment's procurement practices, including all of the different food categories, dairy, meat, vegetables, dry goods, even down to their sugar and their citrus use, as well as whether or not they're members of similar organizations like ROC NYC or the Green Restaurant Association. And the categories are all weighted by the amount of food that they eat. So, of course, if there's a chicken restaurant, they're not going to be penalized for buying maybe one fish that doesn't quite fit our criteria. So there is a recognition of the reality of things where nobody's going to be able to do everything 100% perfect, but to recognize the restaurants that really are making a big difference in the categories that in which they're working.
Well, Maxine, now that we have a better sense of what slow food is, what precisely is slow fashion?
Well, it parallels slow food quite perfectly. I think it's really getting an understanding that our clothing, when it's made from natural fibers, not from oil, which is what synthetic fibers, a lot of it is made out of, starts at the farm. And so it's the exact same issues. It's what is the carbon imprint of the clothing? Are the workers being treated well? What sort of synthetic dyes are being put into the product? It's really taking the entire life cycle of a product and looking through and making sure that it's having the lowest environmental footprint and the highest ethical footprint as well.
And you said that the genesis of your fashion line, Zadie, began with wanting to uncover the why behind low-quality goods. So what did you end up finding out exactly?
Well, I didn't start in this industry. I started out as a lawyer, actually. And it was really a discovery of, I was working in Africa, and in Tanzania I came across this basket, and I fell in love with the design of a basket, and I actually got to see the artisan creating this pattern by folding different reeds, and I was just amazed. I was so impressed with how beautiful this basket came out, and how did this man have this idea in his head? It was this new appreciation that a basket actually isn't come from the back of a West Elm, but it comes from someplace.
Right.
And so I used that lens to just, out of curiosity, just explore where does our clothing come from? And wouldn't it be cool if there was a map of the world where you could see exactly where everything came from? And as, you know, my co-founder and I decided to kind of delve into this and go into it, we saw, well, actually, it's right now impossible to find a clothing brand that actually does tell you not just where the cut and sew takes place, which is the very, very, very last step in a clothing life cycle, but where it came from the farm. And so that was the impetus to create Zadie, was let's go back to the farm. You know, the apparel industry is the second most polluting industry in the world.
I couldn't believe when I read that.
Yeah, nobody ever talks about it. We didn't know about it, but once we did, it's hard to unknow those things. And so it's, let's get back to it, and realizing that when you do, and it's so similar to food, when you do know what's going into the product, you're creating a better product. You're creating something that feels nicer and that fits better.
Well, instead of fabricating trends, Zadie claims to design clothing with living in mind. What does that mean exactly?
So the fast fashion retailers, so those are the retailers that have popped up in the past two decades, they create micro trends so that your wardrobe from one season to the next doesn't make sense together, so that you're almost forced to go back into the store and buy a whole new wardrobe. So what we're doing is, you know, we had all these conversations in the early days with the team, and those conversations still happen, which is there always is that kind of 10% of your wardrobe that you keep going back to, the pieces you keep just wearing because they make sense, they're easy to wear. What if we created an entire line out of just those pieces, out of the pieces that fit well, that are cut well, with they're cut with thought in mind, not just to create a next trend, but to think about how different body shapes are, and to think about what we do during our day. We go, you know, to work, then we go to a restaurant. What actually makes sense in that kind of new lifestyle that we're all living? And so that, you know, that's what kind of the considered design that we bring.
Jennifer, do you find that an obsession with trends frequently leads to unsustainable practices within food culture as well?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, if you just take ramps, for example, which are pretty hot right now, given that they're the only thing that comes up at the very beginning of the season, that's a foraged item, and that's not something that you can just grow acres and acres of and harvest and sell. So there is, and I think there is also an awareness of this within the chef community, so I think most people are coming at this with a sustainable view in mind, but it's a dangerous path to go down when you have an ingredient as a fetish almost, and you will get it at any cost, or people will pay any amount of money for it. It really encourages foragers to go out and just pick them all, and then they won't be there the next year. And there are other things like, you know, if a particular vegetable becomes really hot, fairy tale eggplants a couple years ago, for example, it's hard when one season restaurants and other wholesale buyers demand, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds of them at one time, and then the next year they're not buying them because that, you know, that vegetable was last year, there's another thing this year, and the farm is then probably had planted more, assuming that the demand would be the same as the previous season. So I think when there are trends within the food system, it is hard for the farmers and the food producers to really get a handle on what they should or shouldn't be growing.
So in addition to your vice chairmanship at Slow Foods, Jennifer, you are also the founder of Farmers Web. Good entrepreneurs are adept at identifying problems and solving them. So talk a bit about the problem you identified and how you've attempted to solve it through Farmers Web.
Sure. So we started the company about 4.5 years ago at this point, I guess. And the problem that we saw was a growing interest in sourcing local, sustainably grown produce and other products from chefs. But there was really no easy way to do it besides either going to the farmer's market 3 days a week, hauling back your stuff in the back of a taxi, being incredibly devoted and having a full-time forager with a van, maybe. But those aren't options for everybody. And it takes a lot of time to deal with, you know, maybe 10 to 20 small vendors, finding out what they have available every day, actually placing your orders, and then maintaining all the paperwork that goes on with that relationship. So what we tried to do is create a platform that made that relationship much more easy and much more efficient, with the idea that if sourcing locally was as easy as buying from your broadline distributor, more people would do it and we could get more money into the local food system.
And so this is absolutely free for buyers. Correct. Basically, it's the producers that are putting money into the website, and there are different levels that they could sign up as. So can you just take us through some of the benefits for buyers and also the producers?
Absolutely. So on the producer side, it's a subscription model. So they pay a flat monthly fee depending on how many products that they're selling. There's one lower level for farms that have just 1 to 10 products, then a higher level for farms that are selling as many products as they want to. And for the farms, it's really a very robust inventory management system, a way for them to publicize their availability list, which a lot of them are emailing out every week to chefs right now. This gives them a way to publicize a real-time list that kind of counts down if you have limited numbers as people order. And they can also collect and organize their orders and generate packing slips and have invoices automatically emailed to their buyer customer. And then on the buyer side is kind of a very, it's the flip side of what I just described, where for the buyer, it's a lot easier for them to see the real-time inventory lists of all the farms that they buy from. The prices, as those change, they'll go up and down, the availability and the case counts, and for them to place one order from as many farms as they want to buy from in one shot.
And is this just serving the New York area at this time, or are you rolling it out nationally?
We've been just in New York for the past 3 years. We just launched nationally a couple of weeks ago.
So that's
the new thing on the docket. Yeah.
Wow. Well, and also coming full circle, hasn't Farmers Web actually formed a partnership with Slow Food?
Yeah, it's an informal partnership, mm-hmm. but Farmers Web runs the Slow Food Producer Matrix, which is a tool for chefs that are either part of our snail approval program or would like to become, get to the level where they could be snail approval recognized. It gives those chefs kind of a matrix of all the producers that Slow Food NYC has vetted and approved as producing food in a manner consistent with our values. So it's basically a database with the farm names and the categories of food that they grow, and an easy way for the chefs to find the farms that they want to work with.
Well, Maxine, just like Jennifer, you are juggling two incredible careers, projects at the same time. In addition to Zadie, you founded the Bootstrap Project back in 2010, dedicated to changing the lives of artisans in developing countries. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the Bootstrap Project, as you just described, is working with artisans in places like Zambia and Nepal and Tajikistan. And it really just started from, that story of the basket and me kind of falling in love with how beautiful work is made. And I came at it from a human rights perspective. So I was working as a human rights lawyer, and I was thinking, gosh, wouldn't it be great if I didn't, have to work at the end where all the problems have already happened and I'm trying to resolve a conflict after the fact. But what if I could be a part of something that is investing in sustainable jobs at the outset? And so that was really the impetus to create the Bootstrap Project. And I think what's so exciting in how the world of nonprofits have changed and kind of the cutting edge of nonprofits is that it's so much less about handouts, which when I first got started, that's really what it was about. It was, give these poor people money and then they kind of are addicted to that cycle. And then for us, it's about, oh, we've done this good thing because we've given money away. But that's not sustainable. That doesn't get people out of poverty, doesn't get people to a sustainable job. So the Bootstrap Project is working with micro-entrepreneurs. All of these people are amazing artisans, and they're business people, too, and it's helping them develop those business skills You know, with farming and with clothing and accessories, there's some interesting financing involved. So it's helping them with that understanding, with that education, and connecting them with microfinance loans and really helping them build out their businesses. And that was really, you know, it was getting the Bootstrap project started that then led me to Zadie, because I wanted to have this be not just about helping poor people, but it's really about just knowing wherever in the world your product is getting made, that you get to know more about it. And that can happen from an artisan in Zambia or from an amazing, you know, designer in New York.
I'm always fascinated by the career trajectories of entrepreneurs and innovators such as yourself, because more often than not, your path was neither straight nor expected, which gives hope to the rest of us, certainly. Well, Jennifer, I mean, Maxine said that she went to law school and she has a background in diplomacy. She also clerked for the United Nations, which I don't think that you had mentioned yet. And then Jennifer, you worked in finance. So
I did.
Which I find that is true of a lot of food people. But how did you end up translating a background in finance to a career in food policy?
I think it's really just the basic skills. You know, learning how to use as simple as Excel and PowerPoint, for example, or understanding how to think about a business and look at the numbers and think whether or not it's going to be a sustainable business in terms of the financials behind it. I don't think that mindset is applied to farms. People don't tend to look at farms as a business, which they are, and they need to be able to make more money than they spend in order to stay in business. So I think that just having the basic, you know, business knowledge helps me put that into play for a different segment than who I was previously working for.
Maxine, you had mentioned that really mind-blowing fact that textiles are second only to oil when it comes to the most polluting industry out there. And also, one out of every six people in the world actually work in the textile industry.
That's
so
right.
It's also rife with labor abuses. So how do you attempt to address environmental and humanitarian concerns at every level of the supply chain?
Well, when we first got started, you know, when we realized first that there, you know, wasn't a brand that we could put, there's a lot of great brands doing really good work, but when we were trying to say, okay, well, we know that we've now learned that the apparel industry is the second most polluting, what can we as a company do to offer an alternative that helps? And when we found that the real impact on the environmental side is really in the earlier steps in the supply chain, starting with the farm. The farm has a huge impact on the environmental impact of the garment ultimately. And then so we said, okay, well, we'll just find maybe there's a labeling system, like there's a lead or there's an organic, or, you know, we have to find whatever that label is, and we'll just partner with those people and we'll create a product and that will be it and we're done. But it turns out that the real problem is that the industry is so opaque and nobody knows, no brand knows ultimately where their product is coming from themselves. And they don't know because they've never had to know. And so then we said, okay, well, we're going to be transparent, number one. That's going to be the first thing that we do. And we're going to make that just normal so that it's not that we're eco-fashion or sustainable fashion. This is just going to be what fashion is in the future. It's going to be transparent. And then underlining all of that transparency is getting a better understanding of what are the impacts at each step. What are the impacts on the farm? What are the impacts at the spinning facility? What are the impacts at the knitting facility? And understanding that and publishing that journey with our customers so that they get to learn as we're learning, and really creating that standard for the industry where it will just be what's expected versus, you know, eco-fashion.
I would actually like to close this segment with a recitation of Zadie's manifesto, which also speaks in so many ways to concerns in the food industry as well, just how you identified with the mission statement of Slow Food. I think that Zadie's manifesto really, really speaks to both camps. So I don't know if you have it memorized, Maxine. Otherwise, we could read it or chant it together.
Maybe I'll read it with you.
Okay. Are you ready? All right. Fast fashion is fast food. empty calories that make us full. I'm just going to read it. I caught her off guard. Factories full of mistreated workers, rivers full of toxic chemicals, closets full of disposable wares, landfills full of yesterday's garments. Process matters, quality matters, honesty matters. You're damn right, it's a call to action. Well said, well written. You are listening to Taste Talks on Heritage Radio Network.
And this featured break song is called Anxieties by The Landing. We'll be right back.
Back. I'm your host, Sarah Zorn, and you are listening to Taste Talks on Heritage Radio Network. Now, Casey from Gothamist has joined me and Jennifer and Maxine once more to spotlight a few great restaurants that are really leading the way in the slow food movement. So, guys, when we talk about truly impactful farm-to-table restaurants, I would imagine that almost anyone's mind immediately goes first to Alice Waters' Chez Benice in Berkeley or Dan Barber's Blue Hill at Stone Barns in upstate New York. And for very good reason. It's because of chefs like them and places like those that no self-respecting restaurant nowadays would even dream of serving asparagus in winter or sweet potatoes in the spring. But, you know, beyond those big kahunas that we all know about, what are some other newer, perhaps under-the-radar restaurants that you think are really making a difference in the local, seasonal, sustainable realm? There are those buzzwords again, local, seasonal, sustainable.
They're unavoidable.
They are. That's why I have fatigue, but okay, let's talk. Who's really putting their money where their mouth is when it comes to farm to table?
Well, this is definitely not a new place, but there's a restaurant in Portland, Maine called 4th Street that's been around almost 20 years. And Jennifer and I actually talked about this before the segment. So if you want to weigh in,
it's on my to-do list. I'm going to Portland, Maine this summer. It is on my to-do list.
You will have to stop by. The chef there, Sam Hayward, actually won a Sustainer of the Year award in 2011 by Chefs Collaborative. So already we're off to a good start, a good pedigree there, so to speak. But, you know, he's doing the kinds of things that Jennifer mentioned where he's working with, you know, dozens of different farms and foragers and you know, small producers of food or manufacturers of food to really bring the freshest, most seasonable and local things to his restaurant. And you know, because he's doing this, the menu's never the same, which I think is sort of a hallmark of a slow food restaurant. You know, you don't want to walk into a restaurant and the menu's the same every day, because obviously then you know, okay, well, maybe they're not using the freshest and the most seasonable ingredients. So he's definitely a person who is a big deal in the scene. I don't know, Jennifer, if you wanted to speak. You love that restaurant, you said.
Yeah, no, I've been multiple times. I'll probably go back again this summer, too.
Maybe I'll see you there.
Yeah, it's great. I think he's one of those chefs that really does you know, forge the strong relationships with the farms and works very closely with the farms to have them tell him what to put on the menu rather than the opposite way around, which is the norm in the industry where the chef tells the farm what they are looking for and do you have it? And if so, I'll take it. And if not, I'll get it from elsewhere. So I think he's done a really great job.
So who else has your snail of approval, Jennifer?
Oh, in New York?
Anywhere. I guess specifically in New York for a snail of approval, but anywhere else you've been nationwide.
Yeah. Well, staying on the main theme, they're not snail food NYC approved, of course, but there are so many restaurants up there that I think are doing very similar things, probably inspired by 4th Street, Hugo's, Eventide, Duck Fat. Those are all ones you should definitely visit when you're there. Central Provisions is another one, I think, and it seems like every month another one is popping up, which is great. And there's even one called Vinland, I believe, which where the chef is committed to buying only Maine products, possibly within 100 miles of the region, which I imagine is incredibly difficult in January, but he's making it work somehow.
Wow. Maxine, any restaurants that you feel followed the Zadie's manifesto?
Well, I guess all of those that are farm to table, that's not my realm of expertise. The only thing I can say is I have committed in realizing that I spent all my time thinking about where clothing comes from, that I was going to commit where I would also know where my food comes from. So that's my challenge for the month.
All right, we're going to exchange email addresses with Jennifer so she can point us in the
exactly.
right direction.
And I'll also put in a plug for the snail approval list on the Slow Food NYC website, because there's like 160 restaurants, I believe, that we've certified, and you can know that all of those have gone through that really extreme vetting process.
Well, thank you.
Well, I have got to give a shout out to Andrew Whitcomb at Brooklyn's Own Colony. Do they have a snail of approval? Do you know? They must.
They probably do. I don't know off the top of my head.
Well, he was actually named Star Chef's Rising Star Sustainability Chef this year, and he has put such a focus on vegetables that last year alone he was able to help 5 farmers double their size just because of the amount of product that he bought off of them. So I definitely got to give a shout out to Colony, staying super local there. But also, there are just so many restaurants you're finding throughout New York, New York City, and Brooklyn that are not just making regular trips to the Green Market, but they're actually purchasing and maintaining farms upstate. So they're really, I mean, that's about as farm to table as you could get. We're talking about Applewood and Egg in Brooklyn and Narcissa and Blenheim in Manhattan. So that is that is farm to table to its core.
Absolutely. And I think Green Table just started its own farm as well. I believe that's a new project that they have going on too.
Nice. Well, maybe they will sign up for Farmers Web and send their products elsewhere. So that is our show for today. If you'd like to learn more about Farmers Web, please visit farmersweb.com, check out Zadie at zadie.com, or subscribe to Gothamist's new food newsletter at gothamist.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at SarahZornBK or Taste Talks at Taste Talks. And be sure to subscribe to our brand new podcast feed on iTunes or Stitcher as well. Thank you so much for tuning into our very first broadcast. Woo! Thanks for being here, you guys. We've got some really beautiful ladies in the studio. Too bad this is radio only. Until next time, you've been listening to Taste Talks on Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.